Okay, today you are listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and we are talking to Brendan Campisi, who we have not had on this show in quite some time. Like, when was the last time I had you on this show, Brendan?
It's been a few years for sure.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I've been in China. I've been away. I've been, like, all over the place. So that's really not too surprising. But we've had you on the show a number of times, and we've talked about a lot of different things. Today, we're going to talk about something different. We've got you on the phone from London, Ontario. We wanted to talk about Noel Ignatieff and something about his life. This is a man who, you know, Jewish-American historian, radical historian, you know, like sometimes communist and radical political organizer. Not a lot of people are going to know his name, though. So I think maybe we should start with, who was he and why is he significant? Maybe just kick us off with that.
Sure. So Noel Ignatieff, who passed away last month, was a lifelong participant in the revolutionary left in the United States and did some absolutely crucial, absolutely seminal work on the subject of basically white supremacy and the role that white supremacy plays as something that sort of stabilizes the capitalist social order in the United States, and sort of particularly trying to think through how that can be neutralized, how that effect can be broken up for purposes of communist, you know, revolutionary struggle. So Noel Ignatieff was born in Philadelphia in 1940 into a working class Russian Jewish family. I believe there were communists in his family, and he became a communist as a teenager. Actually, he joined the Communist Party USA during its sort of period of crisis in the late 50s, and he was sort of very quickly attracted to the most left wing of the several factions that had developed within the party, which was a group called the Marxist-Leninist Caucus. And then when it was kicked out of the Communist Party or left, it called itself the Provisional Organizing Committee to Reconstitute the Marxist-Leninist Communist Party USA, or the Provisional Organizing Committee, as it's sort of more simply known. And the Provisional Organizing Committee had a particular base among Black and Puerto Rican communists on the waterfront in New York, and among a sort of a smaller number of white communists who were particularly concerned with white supremacy, which included both the young Noel Ignatieff and Ted Allen, who would be a longtime intellectual partner and political partner of Ignatieff, although they did have certain differences. We'll probably get into that a little bit later. And Ignatieff was in the Provisional Organizing Committee for several years, eventually turned into a bit of a cult-left organization, with its leaders sort of expelling anybody who did successful organizing because they were a threat to the position of the leadership. And that eventually happened to Ignatieff mid-60s, after which time he sort of started to engage with the radical, you know, movement that was developing among students and youth, and sort of engaging in the debates that were developing in that movement around sort of strategy in relation to white supremacy. I feel like we can sort of, you know, go into some of his sort of early contributions from that point.
Yeah, because of course he was working in a steel mill for something like 20 years or something, right? And engaged in like union activity, and like he was very much a, you know, a working class, blue collar person,
right?
You know, and militant.
Yeah. So he'd started university in the early 60s very briefly in Philadelphia, and then dropped out. So he was already working in heavy industry in the, you know, through most of the 1960s before many sort of younger people who'd been radicalized in the student movement started dropping out of school and going to organize the working class. So he already had a fair bit of experience there. And towards the end of the 60s, he sort of helped to pull together a group of people who'd mostly been active in Students for a Democratic Society around Chicago, and they formed a group called the Sojourner Truth Communist Organization, which for most of its existence was just called the Sojourner Truth Organization, named, of course, after the famous black woman abolitionist militant Sojourner Truth. And they started organizing in sort of factories and plants in the sort of the Chicago and Gary area, which, of course, at the time was one of these central sort of nodes of the great, you know, heavy sort of industrial complex in the northeastern United States, you know, around the Great Lakes. And they had a couple of particular, Sojourner Truth had a couple of particular points of distinction in the way that it undertook that organizing. And one had to do with the ideas that Ignatieff had developed around white supremacy. And so his sort of conception of how white supremacy affected the class struggle in the United States was that it was absolutely the central thing. It was the central thing that prevented the working class from constituting itself, you know, politically as a force as opposed to capitalism. It was the central thing maintaining consent for U.S. imperialism, you know, racist U.S. imperialist wars like Vietnam. It was the central thing that weakened the labor movement. It had prevented the existence of a labor party in the United States, because what white supremacy functioned to do was to create, and this was a very controversial idea at the time, although today it's relatively accepted on the left, that white supremacy had functioned to create a class alliance, a cross-class alliance between the white, you know, the white bourgeoisie and white workers, whereby white workers received certain material benefits as long as they were basically compliant with the system. And there were a couple of versions of this argument that were pervaded at the time. And the argument that came from one section of the radical movement, most famously the Weather Underground, was that this was true, and it meant that white workers in the United States could be written off politically. They were essentially hopeless. They were tied to imperialism, tied to the counter-revolution completely. But in Ignatieff's conception, the fact that white workers received material benefits from the existence of white supremacy, in his words, does not negate their exploitation, it reconciles them to it. The fact is that these people are still, you know, they're still exploited workers, and their lives are still affected in all manner of negative ways by that position of exploited workers in a capitalist society. But white supremacy reconciles them to that reality. And the other sort of distinctive point of the Sojourner Truth Organization is working class organizing, which is the main sort of focus in its early phase, in the early 1970s. Was they were deeply, deeply skeptical of union structures. They did not engage in any kind of work within the official structures of unions. They wouldn't run for union office. Unlike many of the new radical organizations that were sending their members into industrial workplaces, they did not try to fight, you know, union bureaucracies with, you know, rank and file caucuses, anything like that. Their conception of workplace struggle was to look at what are the things that workers do on a day-to-day basis outside those structures that, the way that they conceived it was that workers do things on a day-to-day basis in the workplace that reach out towards and that represent an aspiration towards control of their own work and greater control of their own lives. And you can see that sort of especially at heightened moments of struggle, like wildcat strikes and whatnot. And they did their best to, you know, support those when they developed. But you could also see them in sort of day-to-day action at sort of lower points of struggle. And there's a great essay that Ignatieff wrote during this period called Black Worker, White Worker, in which he talked about the things that workers do on the job in order to make their lives easier, essentially. And he used examples of things like workers sort of devising their own sort of schedules and their own divisions of tasks informally so that, you know, people would shift tasks around in a way to get their coworkers extra time off and then, you know, fill in for, you know, and they would then be filled in for later. So something the boss is supposed to control completely, this, you know, scheduling of the workplace, is something that workers were taking a degree of control of. And so Ignatieff and Sojourner Truth more broadly believe that that was where the political potential in workplace struggles was, rather than fighting within the union structure. And the two sort of arguments connected with one another in that, you know, organized labor in the United States at this point, with some exception, had accommodated itself to the sort of the racist division of labor within the workplace, and many, many black workers especially, but also, you know, other racialized workers felt that the unions did not, you know, did not represent them. And they were sort of at the forefront of many of these, you know, these extra union struggles that developed at the sort of the high point and the end of the post-war, you know, economic boom in the 1960s and early 1970s. When that boom ended and you go into a period of recession in the mid-70s, things start to get a lot more difficult for all this kind of work, all this kind of organizing, in that sort of the young combative workers who are at the forefront of those struggles often found themselves getting laid off. It also became much, much more difficult for young revolutionaries, you know, who obviously were going out of their way, you know, to take risks and to start struggles in their workplaces to keep jobs in the sort of the new economic environment. And so STO sort of moved into a different phase in the late 70s, where it focused mainly on international solidarity. They did a lot of work supporting the revolutionary movement in Iran, a lot of work supporting the struggle for independence in Puerto Rico, and then into the 1980s, the organization continued to exist. The organization existed, you know, for about 15 years, and only Ignatius and a handful of other very, very close comrades were in the organization for the entire time. As you can imagine, an organization that goes through, you know, a series of different phases in terms of what its focuses of organizing are going to, you know, is going to attract different people at different times. And then towards the end of the organization's existence in the early 80s, they found themselves in a situation where there were new social movements that were developing all around them, mostly outside the workplace. And, you know, things like there was a very large movement against nuclear power in the United States in the 1980s, or, you know, environmental struggles more broadly. And they would try to engage with these things in order to increase the level of militancy, to advocate sort of more militant, more, you know, extra-legal tactics, which is sort of a thread of continuity with their previous, you know, approach to organizing in the workplace, that they wanted people to go outside of the official structure. So they wanted to take advantage of the fact that people will, in fact, do that already. And they also, within these new movements, advocated an approach to, you know, that emphasized white supremacy. So, for example, within environmental movements and the anti-nuclear movement, STO members would have been the people raising, or they tried to be the people raising, the fact that the nuclear energy industry in the United States is built on the backs of suffering and destruction and disease for indigenous people, for, you know, the Diné people living in the Southwest where uranium is extracted. And so this is not just, you know, this is a threat to everybody, but it has particular, you know, particular consequences for the oppressed people. But eventually what happened with this organization is that they sort of spent their whole existence kind of on this tightrope between a more traditional sort of Leninist organizational theory where building an organization is very important, and a more sort of spontaneous approach where building mass movements is more important. And towards the end, they tilted far enough towards the one side, towards the spontaneous sort of side of that polarity, that they didn't really see any role for the organization as such to continue to exist. So STO dissolved in the mid-1980s, at which point Ignatiev left heavy industry and went back to school. And that sort of opens up a new phase in his career and his work.
Oh, yeah. Because, of course, like, he's coming from this background and then taking it into academia, right? Like, this is his starting point, you know, all his background, all that political organizing, industrial experience, all of that. He takes that into academia. So how does that really shape who he becomes?
Right. I think there's a really, really fantastic interview that Ignacio did, actually just a few weeks, I think, before he passed away, with anarchist news outlet, It's Going Down. And I would encourage listeners who want to know more about Noel Ignatiev to track down that interview. And he says, you know, that he spent 23 years in industry and 32 years in academia while pursuing his real career as a revolutionary. So in some ways, there's a, you know, there's a lot of continuity between the different phases of his life, regardless of how he was paying his bills. And, you know, I don't, you know, we're all living in a non-revolutionary situation. And I would never, you know, despite the fact that I, you know, would love to see radical social transformation and try to act on that basis, I would call myself a revolutionary. But when Noli Natchev did that, I feel like it was fair. But in any case, sort of picking up the thread again. So he went to Harvard after leaving the steel industry. And even though he had dropped out of his first attempt at university education, he was able to progress through things very, very quickly. And this is something that people who leave the ranks of left cadre organizations often have advantages in these things, because they've spent a lot of time learning how to write and how to put together a rigorous argument already, even if it's not in the exact sort of form of academia. So by the early 1990s, he was a professor at Harvard, and that's where he came up with a couple of projects to try to popularize the ideas about white supremacy, about class struggle, about American society as such, that he developed, in that earlier phase of political work. And in mid-90s, he published a book called How the Irish Became White, which is sort of intended to be a case study in the role of white supremacy and how it works by taking a group of European people who arrived in the United States essentially ignorant of the structure of white supremacy and with a history of, colonial oppression, obviously under British rule in their home country, and how they integrated into that structure of white supremacy and adopted racism. And he takes a kind of tragic approach to this, which is actually quite consistent in his sort of attitudes towards, the integration or the partial integration, of white working people into the system. And there's an anecdote at the beginning of How the Irish Became White where he describes, sitting on his porch one day years before and seeing a woman very nearly close the door of a car on her child's hand by accident. And then when she stopped, she laughed and then cried and then starts hitting the child. And he says that, his attitude toward the subjects of the study represents, similar feelings and similar stresses to those that he witnessed, in that mother. So it's written with this a really impressive sort of degree of empathy and historical imagination. And it sort of talks about, the early conditions of Irish migration to the United States and the conditions in which, black people and Irish people live together in quite, close proximity, doing the same jobs, living in the same neighborhoods, lots of romantic and sexual relationships going on in the early 19th century. And then how the Irish people faced with living in a competitive capitalist society where they had to scramble for access to every social resource, seized on the fact that, as Ignatius put it in some of his early writings, that white supremacy structures that competition that exists between working people and capitalist society, and that they could get on the right side of it, and so they could have access to better paying work, they could have access to better living conditions, they could have political power, they were able to become citizens, they were able to vote. And even, before the Civil War, black people, even free black people in many northern states could not vote. So they were able to become sort of full citizens through white supremacy. And by the later, by the later part of the 19th century, the Irish, are a big part of, the democratic political machines in many American cities. They're a huge part of the police force in many American cities. And they've sort of worked their way into the institutions that, provide a certain baseline. Although, as he says, it doesn't mean that all the Irish became rich. And there are still, there are many Irish Americans, today, who are still, towards the lower end of the working class in many ways. But it meant that they were on the right side of sort of the most important line in American society. society in terms of this sort of caste position, in terms of, you know, vulnerability to certain kinds of, having vulnerability to certain kinds of violence or not having it, in terms of the sort of, you know, the dignity and public respect or lack thereof that comes from your position in this sort of, you know, the system of racial oppression. And that book was actually quite successful. It got a lot of attention. And then in the later 90s, Ignatius started getting a lot of attention as, you know, a Harvard professor who wanted to abolish the white race, in his words, was bound to. And a lot of, you know, conservative interests and racists and people who either didn't understand what Ignatius was talking about or who chose not to understand what he was talking about tried to turn, you know, Ignatius' rhetoric about abolishing the white race into some kind of animus against, you know, people of European descent as such. Obviously, that's nonsense. You know, Ignatius was white in that sense, and he addressed himself to, you know, an audience of white people trying to change their ideas about their place in the world. And obviously, if it needs to be said, when Ignatius talked about abolishing the white race, he was talking about abolishing a social and political structure and not getting rid of, you know, Euro-descended people. He compared it to abolishing royalty, which is not the same as killing members of the royal family. But he had a certain degree of notoriety at this point. This is, you know, about 20 years ago. He was sort of famous in a strange way. And he continued to engage in a number of other projects to try and popularize these ideas. And in the late 90s, he started a publication called Race Traitor, which was based on, you know, on these ideas. And the idea was, for this project specifically, that it would be used to reach out to white people who were, quote, dissatisfied with the terms of membership in the white club, right? Ignatieff always believed that there were more cracks in these structures of ruling class ideology and ruling class domination than you might think, that there were more people who were supposed to be on one side of these lines who were in one way or another dissatisfied, and that it was very, very important to reach out to those people to show them that they were not alone in questioning the way that society worked, that they were not alone in, you know, not wanting to live in a society where, even though they had these certain material benefits, those benefits were based on violence and oppression for other people. And so Race Traitor was an attempt to, to sort of reach out to and to shore up those sort of white dissidents in a way. And that continued for a number of years. Eventually he, you know, he retired from Harvard. The sparks of, you know, this sort of notoriety that had come from people misinterpreting these ideas for so many years, sort of faded away. In the last few years of his life, apparently, on the basis of sort of suggestions from some former readers of Race Traitor that it would be good to bring back the publication, he started sort of his last political project, which is a publication called Hard Crackers, which is still going. I don't know sort of specifically how, you know, they plan to kind of reorient in the aftermath of Ignatius' death, because he was sort of the central figure. And so Hard Crackers was founded on the idea, again, that there are bound to be people everywhere in an unequal and oppressive and violent society who are dissatisfied with it in different ways that don't necessarily match up with sort of formal politics, and that there are people who will be engaging in things in their day-to-day lives that sort of play on those, on the cracks and the contradictions in those systems. And the idea was for people to, it was and is, you know, for people to basically write for this publication to describe, you know, their experiences along the cracks of society. A friend of mine who's been involved in the project has written a bit for them about their experiences sort of along the fissures of gender and masculinity, for example. That sort of rounds out his life. And I think, again, this last interview that he did is a really, really good both description of his ideas, which he continued to, you know, to propound in more or less the same way that he had for 50 years, which I think is absolutely, you know, ab- admirable, not just in itself, but also because I think he was right. I think his ideas are just head and shoulders above most other Marxist analyses of white supremacy, and definitely above liberal anti-racism in a lot of ways. But he, I think it's incredibly impressive that he, even having lived through this period of great revolutionary upheaval in the world in the 60s and 70s, and then through this period of long, this long period of defeat and retreat for various, various radical projects, that he continued to have this really, really profound faith that, so-called ordinary people would not only continue to resist, but always had within them, within their actions and their relationship, the seeds of a better society, the seeds of a new world.
Mm-hmm. And that is pretty impressive. Like, he manages to keep that going, like, through all that time, through all that change, through all that upheaval. And I see some continuity there, like, between, like, what he was doing in the factory, where, of course, he's focused more on, like, what do these workers do, like, in their everyday lives, like, away from, like, say, the traditional ideas of like, union politics and things like that. What do they do in their actual life and his later projects?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, there seems to be, like, quite a bit of carryover there. So, like, what would you say his – I mean, this is quite a broad question, but, like, what would you say his legacy really is? Because, like, he obviously did a very, very radical thing here, in addressing whiteness and addressing the race divide and bringing it to the forefront and challenging it and calling for the abolition of whiteness itself. Like, this is something that virtually no one else has had the courage to do.
Yeah, I think that is sort of – I think his main legacy is that work on, on white supremacy. And that, that has a number of different sort of impacts in the world today. Like, in the early 60s – or in the late 60s, when sort of the main period of this, this writing and this argument sort of began – Ignatieff and his comrades used the language of white privilege. And today, of course, that's a very, very common phrase, and it's used by all kinds of different actors to use all kinds of different things. And in some of his later writing, Ignatieff said that he wished that he'd been able to come up with some different word that would not have been, prey to the same sort of, what he saw, and I would tend to agree, as sort of misuse of that concept. And we see how, in some sort of liberal uses, it gets turned into something, very, very much focused on the individual, and that sort of can lead to people being sort of more preoccupied with their individual sort of sense of guilt than sort of the collective radical project that Ignatieff was always was about. But even the fact that there is, a widely diffused awareness, that you can see, people writing in mainstream publications about, the history of whiteness, the history of, how different European, immigrant groups in North America have been faced with various kinds of oppression early on in their histories and have sought to sort of claw their way into that structure in order to, to ease their way in a competitive and unequal society. I think in a way is an achievement, for Ignatieff and the others who were involved in developing these ideas, even if sort of the radical charge is maybe blunted a little bit. And then I think within, within radical movements and radical circles, Ignatieff's legacy is very much present in the fact that, before the late 1960s, the predominant approach to, race and the class struggle was a very, very simplistic sort of black and white unite and fight orientation. And the idea was that you just find demands that work for everybody in a superficial sense without sort of being aware of the way that can just sort of paper over divisions within different sections of the working class and can end up with, and has many, many times in the history of the labor movement on this continent especially, led to sort of the more privileged sections of the working class forming various kinds of accommodations and leaving, the more oppressed sections, in the dust. And Ignatieff argued very, very forcefully that the way you build any kind of working class unity that is worth something, any kind of, unity and a base for, a radical, anti-capitalist project that's worth something, is by, standing foursquare on the demands and the needs of the most oppressed and building around that, even if it is unpopular at first, even if it is politically difficult to do. And obviously, you know, there's ongoing debates around how to do these things on the left, and certainly that kind of sort of class reductionist sort of position of simplistic unity that ends up not being unity has not gone away. But I think that if you look at sort of, you know, generationally over the past several decades, the balance has, you know, has shifted more and more, I think, towards a more sophisticated, you know, approach to those questions, and towards an approach that does say, you know, that we have to focus on the demands, the needs, the interests, the existing struggles, you know, of the most oppressed. And I think that's I think having played a role, although, you know, I'm sure he'd be the first to say that, you know, all of these questions are forced onto the agenda of, you know, white and otherwise sort of socially privileged leftists by the struggles of oppressed people. But, you know, nonetheless, having played a role in, you know, pushing that shift, I think is a an extremely, you know, admirable legacy for anyone.
Yeah, I would say. So thank you very much, Brendan Campisi. Like, I'm really glad you came on the show and talked about this quite remarkable man.
Yeah, I had the opportunity.
And his remarkable contribution here. And I'm glad that you contributed to the show again.
Yeah,
after quite a long period of time. So we got to have you on again at some point. All right.
Anytime.
Okay, all right. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay, have a good one.